Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming out this Sunday morning to discuss some of the small questions, emotions, politics, why we're all so divided. So I'm Bridie Jabbour, and I am joined this morning by some towering intellects. We have William Davis, writer of Nervous States, How Feelings Took Over the World and the Happiness Industry. Jeff Sparrow, writer, editor, broadcaster, and author of Trigger Warnings, Political Correctness and the Rise of the Right, among many, many other books, but I'm not going to list them all. That's the one you should buy this morning. And Eleanor Gordon-Smith, philosopher, radio producer, and author of Stop Being Reasonable, a collection of true stories about how people change their minds. Now, it's extremely tiresome to reference George Orwell at the moment, but I'm going to do it anyway. He's written, "Men are infinitely malleable." I get the sense from all of your books that you would agree with that. But what I want to know, is it a good or bad thing? William.
The men are infinitely malleable? I think infinitely malleable is a bad thing. I mean, and I'm not sure I would agree with that statement. I mean, I think that, I mean, we live in a time where the reason people are reading Orwell and Hannah Arendt and so on all over again is, and the term propaganda is everywhere right now in relation to things like fake news and so on. I think one of the great problems and questions that all of that, those developments of the sort of resurgent fear of propaganda poses is that right now we don't really know the scale or the effects of that propaganda. It's a far more surreptitious type of propaganda than the classically Orwellian one or the sort that Arendt was writing about in the 1940s and 50s, in that it goes via networks where what we encounter as news and information and so on might be very different from what someone just living down the same street as us encounters. And I think so a lot of the anxiety around malleability right now isn't just how malleable are people, but to what extent are people encountering the world on very, very different terms via very, very different sorts of voices and language.
So do you think there is a way to persuade, do you think there's an agreed set of facts that people can be persuaded to?
I think, I mean, one of the things I try to do in the book is to understand what do we even mean by a fact in the first place. And I think that, I mean, facts have never been undisputed. There's not been a golden age where everyone has agreed on everything in the same way. I think that facts depend on a certain kind of social and political infrastructure through which people can accept an account of the world in spite of all sorts of other cultural and moral differences they might have with one another, such as, you know, the temperature or what does the map of Australia look like. Well, there are various things that we do find it possible to agree upon. But I don't think that, I mean, facts themselves are not tools of persuasion. And that's one of the reasons why political movements and parties that try to build their authority on facts, and I think, you know, in the UK, this was something that the pro-EU campaign in the Brexit referendum got very wrong, was to think that people just kind of inevitably fall into line behind facts. I don't think that's ever been the case. Facts have always depended on the health of all sorts of other institutions in the public sphere and in politics for their authority, and a lot of the time, there's been all sorts of pockets of society that have not accepted facts, but have had very little voice and very little power to do anything about it, and of course, that's one thing that the internet has changed.
And do you think that people's malleability has a big role in our current political climate, Jeff?
Yeah, well, I guess I'd answer your initial query about whether people are malleable in two parts. I'd say yes and no. That I think that there's a sense in which people are certainly capable of changing, often far more so than progressives give them credit for. I mean, think of the referendum over same-sex marriage in Australia, where you had electorates in Tasmania where only a few decades ago the overwhelming majority of people had voted to keep homosexuality a criminal offence. Then in the space of two decades, those electorates returned a yes vote. And this is a striking political change in political attitudes. So I think people are certainly capable of changing themselves as they change the world. At the same time, I think one of the difficulties with so much of our politics today is it's predicated on this deep pessimism about the structures of the world being capable of change, that we have to take for granted that the particular kind of world that we live in now is permanent and essential. And once we accept that, then it shifts us to a political project where we see ourselves as trying to change people from above. If you see what I mean, we accept that the world can only be the way that it is now, and then what we need to do is change people to fit in with it. And the problem with that, of course, is that when you're dealing with something like climate change, there's no progressive way to change people so that they're better suited to a world, to the dystopian world that we're creating now. What we need to do is change the structures of society to avoid climate change. And that's a quite different project, if you see what I mean.
Just one small task. And what about you, Eleanor? You have written the book about people being malleable and how they change their minds. Do you think it's a good thing for people to be malleable?
I mean, the first thing to say is that I want to qualify enormously the sense in which they are malleable. So I've spent close to 2 years now asking precisely the question of whether people are malleable and under what circumstances. And it started, in fact, ironically enough, through my own experience with people's profound refusal to be malleable. So my introduction into this very question was that I made a radio program for a US radio show where the central conceit was like seemed pretty straightforward. And what I was going to do was walk around King's Cross and wait to be catcalled, which didn't take very long. And then the idea was I was just going to turn around to these guys and say, like, what were you hoping for with that? Like, why would you do that? And once I had the answer, I thought that I would be able to just say, well, like, women don't like it. It's really deeply unpleasant. And now, voila, a triumph of persuasion. What a wonderful moment of connection we've both had. And thank you so much for your commitment to not catcalling again. You'll be astonished to hear that this didn't happen, right? And in fact, what happened was I spent 3, 4, 5 weeks pacing around outside in King's Cross, having conversations with increasingly drunk and belligerent men at sort of 1 and 2 in the morning. And I like lost a piece of my soul and gained some pretty important knowledge, which was that when people are malleable and when people do come to accept things that are deeply confronting for them to accept and that threaten to tear apart a big part of their identity and the way that they see the world, that process is going to be extraordinarily idiosyncratic, very difficult to generalize, and not the kind of thing that is done with argument alone. So then I spent 2 years interviewing people who had done precisely that, interviewing people who had changed their minds under really high-stakes scenarios. And these were people who had been malleable. These were people who had pulled off a change in a way that the King's Cross guys just hadn't. And the thing that I think really stood out to me about every single one of those stories, I mean, I spoke to a guy who left a cult after he had been born into it and raised in it for 25 years. I spoke to someone who found out that her husband was harboring this terrible criminal secret. I spoke to someone who had to change her mind about whether her own memory of being abused as a child was accurate. I spoke to someone who went on a reality TV program and trained in this kind of area that was really foreign to him. He was like an Oxbridge fancy sort of punt riding Cambridge guy, and he trained as a bouncer on this reality TV show, and suddenly had this crisis where he was like, I don't know which of these people I really am. And in each of those stories and in the catcalling experience, the important thing was that the question isn't as large as, are people malleable? The question is, can this person be malleable, and if so, why? And that requires so much attention to the idiosyncratic reasons why they think what they think that I think it's close to impossible to get a general answer to whether malleability is good or bad.
And so what circumstances did you find that people could be malleable or their minds could be changed? Because there were some pretty extraordinary circumstances.
Yeah. I mean, the strange thing about the whole experience for me was that it felt so intimate to hear these stories. So when people told me about, you know, this moment in their life where everything they'd thought suddenly collapsed, It's really difficult to hear that as an interviewer and as a reporter, and to not feel like you're learning something that, like, maybe you almost shouldn't be learning, because so much of their self and so much of the intimate details of their life and their hopes and their fears and who they love goes into that moment that you listen to it. And, like, often they would say, and I would say, this kind of feels perilously close to therapy. But the thing that I think was really most interesting about what made people be malleable was that it required so much more than just an argument. It was a conspiracy of things, a happy conspiracy of the way they felt at the time, their sense of self, who they happened to believe, what they were hoping for, the facts that struck them as relevant. I mean, the simplest thing to say, which we all know anyway, is it's complicated.
In Trigger Warnings, Jeff Sparrow, you write, it's not just that the left and right consider each other repellent. It's also that they find each other almost incomprehensible. I just want you to quickly explain why that is.
Yeah, so I think that that's not just an incomprehensibility about values or politics, that it's an incomprehensibility about basic facts. So, for instance, if you listen to most of the conservative culture warriors talking about universities in Australia, or indeed around the world, they will present them as these places that are governed by these crazy radical professors who are imposing these far out, Marxist ideas on all of their students, and, you know, forcing them with a kind of iron will to accept these notions. Well, you know, for me, the contacts that I've had with universities, and I've briefly worked in them, the modern Australian university is a $1 billion corporation. I think the average salary of a vice chancellor in Australia is $890,000. That, insofar as there are any kind of lefty academics, they're mostly on part-time or casual salaries and have almost no influence or power of any kind. So there is a clear, like, there is a factual disagreement here about what these institutions are like. In the book, I talk about an Australian conservative commentator, a guy called Nick Adams, who was a Liberal Party councillor in Ashfield before he went to America to reinvent himself as a Fox News commentator. And he's got a book called Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness, where he describes political correctness as the single biggest danger to liberty in America over the past few decades. And, you know, I hear that and then I think of, I don't know, all revelations about the National Security Agency supervising, or literally surveilling literally millions of Americans. I think of, you know, targeted assassinations. I think of Guantanamo Bay. I think of the Patriot Act. All of these extraordinary incursions onto civil liberties. Yet, Nick Adams isn't an outlier. There is a wide layer of American society that actually thinks political correctness is this totalitarian regime that's been imposed on American life. And in that sense, it's almost like the two realities do not even collide, if you see what I mean.
William, do you think this polarisation that we have at the moment between the left and the right is a new phenomenon?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is in its current guise. I think that it's the way in which particular kind of cultural divides have been kind of reinforced around things like, I mean, Jeff's already mentioned the universities where accidents. You know, in 50% of people in the United States and in Britain go to university now. This now represents a kind of binary split down the middle of society, equally sort of city and divides between cities and rural and town areas of generating many of these kind of cultural divides. Now, I mean, the internet is something that gets a lot of the flack for these sorts of divides, and I think that it certainly has some made a very important contribution here, particularly obviously in the more kind of extreme ends where you get the conspiracy theories and the Alex Jones type sort of online news or conspiracy theory sources. I think one thing that has become clear more recently in the analysis of this, particularly in the United States, is the contribution that sort of legacy, old, sort of mainstream media also makes to it. In America, there's an excellent book called Network Propaganda by Yochai Benkler and others, which shows that actually what happened in the United States in the build-up to Trump's election wasn't simply about sort of Facebook and YouTube and conspiracy theories and so on, but it was the crucial way in which Fox News and Breitbart also contributed to the circulation of that online content, so that what people saw on their televisions and what they saw on Facebook and what they heard on their radio were all reinforcing each other. And that is actually a very, very powerful effect in a way that they also show does not happen in the same way on the left, because you've got a whole kind of media ecology that links up CNN, New York Times, the whole way out to the left of Jacobin or whatever it might be. And I think that that's something we need to recognize in a kind of pre-internet era. Newspapers were still trying to do this kind of stuff to some extent. I mean, there were particular newspapers, particularly I think on the conservative right, that have generated something like a sort of an echo chamber or filter bubble or a sort of culture war, but were unable to do so to the same extent until they were supplemented by things like social media. So we mustn't kind of fall into the trap of kind of blaming everything on Facebook or on some kind of shady analytics of Cambridge Analytica in the background, although I think it kind of is layered upon existing divides that really go back to the 1970s.
Do you think that the reemergence of white nationalism can be defeated? Is there a way that we can turn that around?
Well, you have to hope so. I mean, I don't have the answer for what can be done there. But I think it you have to hope that it can be turned around. Yeah, I think.
Well, do you think that we could reach a critical? Like, will it be a critical moment of trauma?
Yeah.
You're meant to be holding like the keys to the world at the moment. Will there be a critical moment of trauma that is going to turn this around, or do you think that we can do it in a more civilized, safer way?
Well, I mean, I think that there are political events which pull in the opposite direction, and so we mustn't only focus on the more extremes, because it's that focusing on the extremes that, in some sense, contributes to the problem that we're discussing. I mean, for instance, thinking again back to the UK, I mean, attitudes towards immigration have been growing more and more favourable over recent years, at precisely the time when immigration politics was sort of coming to a head around Brexit and various other things. It kind of forced various people to confront the kind of tangible reality of immigration rather than some sort of fantasy of it, and to actually think about how immigration actually works. Things become rather more kind of prosaic, more empirical, more mundane in some ways. And actually, in some respects, I think that there is a sort of, you know, we have to still trust in some of the old tools of reporting, of social science, of facts, but not assume that these are going to look after themselves and can persuade people on their own, because that's not the case. I think equally, a lot of the there is in psychology, there are these kind of hopes that are placed in what's called contact theory, which is that people's capacity to understand each other increases massively when they actually encounter one another properly, which of course they don't do when they're simply hearing what Breitbart is telling them is going on in universities of the sort that Jeff was talking about. So there's a huge amount of what in psychoanalytic terms would be called splitting, where effectively there is some kind of other that becomes the sort of carrier of everything that is bad in society, whether that be the immigrant, the welfare claimant, the refugee, or the cultural Marxist in the university, or something like that. But in order for that splitting to work, you have to never actually meet one of those people. And as soon as you do, it no longer is quite so simple. And I think that, I mean, as rather sort of, it might sound like just sort of more soft liberalism, but I think to genuine contact has a very different effect from some of the kind of processes that are playing out in the media sphere.
Eleanor, you literally wrote the book on persuasion. Can you persuade a white supremacist not to be a white supremacist?
Yeah, I said to Bridie before we came on stage, you can't write a book on persuasion and not expect to get this question. I mean, all right, there's a couple of things to say. The first is, no one knows. Like, we haven't seen anything like this before. The fascism that we are dealing with that is on the rise in Brazil, in Hungary, in the United States, all over the world, it is quite unlike the versions of fascism that we've seen before. Not insofar as it's completely different and a totally new phenomenon, but we haven't seen fascism abetted by Facebook before. We don't know these online sub-communities and how they proliferate. I mean, they have a literal language of memes and specific in-group talk that the rest of us haven't deciphered yet. So the possibility of having theorized about this successfully is, I think, a pretty low possibility. So it's the first thing to say is this is like a massive guessing game. But the second kind of more optimistic thing to say is I know it's possible for white nationalists to change their mind because I've seen it happen. So there is an organization in the United States called Life After Hate, and they are a wonderful organization of people who used to go to the rallies in Charlottesburg. They would carry the torches and they thought the horrific things that white nationalists do. And then for a variety of really weird, idiosyncratic reasons, something broke in them and they thought, I don't want to do this anymore. And it's striking the number of times those people tell their stories, and it turns out to be something that wasn't even a little bit about persuasion. It was something to do with them. It was a personal moment for them. So a really common one is that people will say after they've left white nationalist organizations that they were never in the white nationalist organization for what it believed, that they never really had that strong a commitment to this horrific race material. And that, in fact, for them, what it was just that someone somewhere finally wanted them to be a member of something. And that for their whole lives, their families and their friends, such as they were, had rejected them. And that being a Nazi was the closest thing that they could get to belonging. But the problem with that is people hear this story and they think, like, isn't that wonderful? If we could only hug Nazis more, we would be able to stop them being Nazis. And the problem is that that overgeneralization, it has a very high cost. Because if we're wrong, the rest of us will just be hugging Nazis and not making them not Nazis anymore. So it's a really, really difficult question. And I think the actual thing that it calls for us to do is to look with attention and a desire for specificity at what happens inside real people's mind changes, and to stop the tendency that I have and that I think we all have to like look for this self-soothing fiction that we can theorize about what reasoning and persuasion is from like a literal armchair and work it out. I think that these things are possible, but that we are nowhere near the level of information that we need to start predicting what will do it.
Mm. Maybe if I could jump on the white nationalism thing, because it's been something I've been working on a little bit lately. And I think one thing it's really important to realise in the Australian context, the number of genuine white nationalists or fascists in Australia is very, very small. It hasn't really grown that much in the last 20 or 30 years. There's a handful of people who are now far more prominent in the public eye than they previously were, but the organisations haven't grown at all. What they have done is they've grown online. In the real world, they're still tiny and marginal. And in some ways, I think the real danger with these people isn't so much the fringe elements, it's that so many of their underlying ideas have been mainstreamed. So the most obvious one, I think, is Islamophobia or bigotry about Muslims, because since 9/11, it seems to me, we've seen a normalization of almost all of the tropes that were associated with traditional anti-Semitism. That, you know, if you think about the traditional arguments of the anti-Semite, it would be that Jews wear strange clothing, they eat strange food, they keep to themselves, they're connected with political violence, they're connected with criminality, they're simultaneously this tide that's sweeping over the world, plus they also control the world. All of those tropes are now being manifested in terms of Islamophobia, and it's not just from the fringe right. You can write a column for a mainstream paper saying, you know, the good Muslims have to distinguish themselves from the bad Muslims. If you wrote that about Jewish people, you would be rightly condemned as an anti-Semite and you'd be thrown out of polite conversation. You can do it about Muslims and nobody says a word about it. And we saw with the Christchurch killing how these kind of attitudes can be weaponized. And then we saw with the synagogue shooting recently in America, the crossover between Islamophobia and traditional anti-Semitism is so easy because the structures are so similar. In some ways, I think that's the real danger. It's not the tiny skinheads so much. It's the mainstream enablers of the ideas that are behind them.
And do you think that the rise in fascism that we're seeing, I mean, just going back to what Eleanor said at the beginning of her answer, do you think the rise in fascism we're seeing at the moment is different to, you know, a century ago or a few decades ago? Do you think it is a different kind of fascism?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think fascism in the classic period in the 20s and the 30s is a mass organisation. It's a mass mobilisation that's designed to claw back every element of democratic space and to combat social democracy and the trade unions in a period of political and economic crisis. We're not in that period today, and I think one of the things that we're seeing now is that the reasons why these people are turning to terrorism, like Christchurch or like this recent synagogue shooting, is precisely because on the one hand, they see that they're gaining support online, that they have these communities that you talked about on, you know, 4chan or whatever, but they can't translate that into a mass organization in the real world, and they resort to terrorism as a kind of despair. Like you read in this manifesto, they say, no one's doing anything. I have to be the first. I'm going in. And I think the really scary thing about this recent synagogue shooting is how closely it imitated the manifesto of the guy in Christchurch, using the same memes, the same language, saying I was explicitly inspired by this person. And that's the modus operandi. So we're talking, I think, about an increasing likelihood of fascist terrorism, not fascist street movements in the old way.
I think that sometimes it can feel that we are in a really unique moment of political crisis around the world. Obviously, the rise of fascism, you know, Donald Trump's in the White House, Brexit keeps going and going and going. But how, William, you do discuss this in Nervous States. How much do you think has really changed in the past couple of decades? And do you think this is a unique moment?
Well, I think there's a cliche of history. It doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And there's that, there, in some sense, you can see the echoes. And I mean, there are moments, people point to the late 19th century where you had anti-Semitic conspiracies around the Dreyfus Affair. The 1930s gets repeatedly talked about. I also, in my book, look at some of the kind of the origins of nationalism in the early 19th century, which always, nationalism from its inception has always been something that's worked on our feelings, on multi-sensory ways of encountering the world, on via music, via symbols, via great sort of rhetoric, and so on. So this sense that reason is under attack from feeling or emotion is certainly not unprecedented by any means. In some sense, it's a sort of old as modernity, the kind of feeling that some sort of counter-modern or counter-rational political movement is sweeping over us in some sense. I think that one thing which we should pays quite a lot of attention to, though, is quite the rise of photography and video in everyday life as a result of the explosion of bandwidth over the last 15 years, combined with the smartphone. And actually, a lot of, if you think about what's happened to our public sphere and our news environment and the way in which arguments break out about certain things, very often these are generated, at the heart of them, are photographic and video content, which ultimately are matters of perspective. They have an aesthetic effect on us. They do not work purely via a sort of verbal representation of the world. I think this is partly one of the contributors to the way in which our politics have become much more sort of affective and emotional, but also much faster. And I think that one of the threats here, which is really, I suppose, what I'm most concerned with in my book, is that the sheer speed of political communication and economic and cultural change is such that a lot of what we can talk about and fear as fake news and post-truth is simply the fact that lies can zip around on Twitter and so on far faster than it's possible to check them all. Someone like Donald Trump, I mean, it doesn't matter that he keeps on lying, because by the time his lies have been properly and effectively called out by the fact checkers, he's already on to the next lie. And I think that the speed of communication in this present moment is unprecedented. And I think that, as much as anything else, is leading us to sort of more extreme sentiments seem to take on a kind of life of their own, even in spite of whether or not they have any kind of mass support.
Do you think it's possible to separate emotion from reason?
Well, not in any sort of strict behavioral sense. You can't say this person is behaving rationally and this person is behaving emotionally, because any human being has a sort of mixture of capabilities that they are constantly using all at the same time. And I think the other thing that has swept our culture in the last 25 years or so is the influence of the neurosciences, where increasingly we sort of, you know, where once we might have attributed something in ourselves to our minds, we now attribute it to our brains, which immediately gives them a physiological, chemical dimension. And one of the most influential pieces of neuroscientific discovery is the work of the neuroscientist Antonio Damasio, where he looks at the way in which rational thought and rational decision-making and emotion are fundamentally inextricable. These are not things that they don't belong in different parts of the brain, they're not different parts of the self, and if you're not capable of one, you're not capable of the other. So I think that argument has kind of been lost certainly on a neurological level, but I think it's been lost on a philosophical level as well. What we can do is defend the institutions and the practices that allow for reasoned deliberation. And when I say reasoned, I mean the spaces in which people can justify and give reasons for why they think what they do, which things like Twitter are not that space, because, you know, it's the old Ronald Reagan phrase, when you're explaining, you're losing. You know, we do live in a moment where if you want to start laying out your reasons for why you think something, already you've lost your audience, because everything is moving around photographically, videographically, at very high speed. So I think this is an institutional challenge and not something that can be solved by reverting back to what, you know, fundamentally is rationality and how can we split off emotions from that.
Eleanor, you write quite extensively about this in your book. What role do you think emotion does have to play in our politics?
Yeah, it's a really good question. This is a smart enough audience, so I'm going to do some philosophy. All right. So as well as working in radio and doing these interviews, my day job is that I'm a philosopher. And I cannot begin to describe the frustration and the hair-tearing that it causes me as a philosopher to listen to people just in their everyday life try to think about reason and emotion as though they even could be separated. So here is something that I think it's really interesting for us to ask ourselves, and something that I think that, like, we are up to the challenge of asking ourselves and that we should be asking ourselves. It's like, why do we think that's a thing? Why do we think that rationality and emotion could be separable, and then why do we think that they should be separable? So it's important to distinguish, there's two different kind of questions there. One is a descriptive one. One is, what in fact does emotion give us in our politics? And that is a question about how effective being emotional is in your argument. You know, there's questions about what in fact is the influence of our politicians being emotional on us. That is a question for an actual empirical fact-based investigation. And there's another question, which is, what actually are the rational justifications for some of the ways that we feel? And I think that one thing that it's super easy to lose sight of is that the question of what emotions do or of how justified they are might not just reduce off to their effects. So what I mean by that is, there's plenty of emotions that are responses to facts and that are apt ways of seeing the world. So, you know, this is something that you will know if you've ever been a person who is marginalized or who is not taken seriously or for whom the systems around you are a grave disappointment every day of your life. There is a constant cacophony of anger and resentment about living inside that world. And it's really a question I think we need to ask about, why do we think that feelings like that ought to be separated from reasoned argument? Because this is something that, you know, a lot of philosophers like Marilyn Frey and Alison Jagger that do a lot of work on, is that anger and resentment are moral emotions, which is to say that they contain a thought about how the world should be. And that can be hugely powerful. I mean, it was Audre Lorde who said that all women have inside them like a stock of resentment and anger against the oppressions that created that anger, and that can be a huge source of energy against those very oppressions. And that's something that I wish we paid more attention to in the way that we talk about our politics and, you know, our political discourse, is things like emotions can be ways of getting knowledge about how messed up the world is. And if we don't recognize that, then often what happens is the people in this room and in the world who sit around feeling emotional all the time get convinced that they're being irrational, when in fact what might be the case is that they're seeing the world the way they should.
Absolutely. I mean, that's I certainly can't improve on that way of expressing that point. I just wanted to kind of add another sort of supplement to that, which is, I think maybe one thing we can try and distinguish is a type of anger such as the one that it develops from being a member of a community that is not taken seriously, that is not recognized, not respected, not heard over a long period of time, and which kind of builds up. It becomes a kind of a... I think Peter Sloterdijk has this phrase, rage banks, and I mean, he's a rather more kind of conservative thing than the ones you're talking about, but nevertheless, there's an interesting kind of image of this thing where you can kind of, you know, this thing which builds over time. A lot of the rage we see in our politics right now, which we associate with populism, of course it may have constituencies of, you know, the famous left behind of the white working class who might have developed that kind of a sort of rage bank. But a lot of the kind of figureheads who are perceived to be bringing emotion into politics, like Donald Trump, their rage is purely kind of real time. It's purely sort of performed. It's something which they can sort of do on stage. It's something that which is kind of, it's aggression, it's hostility. It's something which is very much in the kind of real time. And in that sense, it doesn't necessarily, it's not perhaps so easy to kind of think about what that has to do with reasons or causes in some way. So I think one thing which I'm very interested in anyway is the temporality of what you're describing, and how some actually speaks of a history and speaks of experiences in ways that are amenable to a kind of a discussion of facts, because these are factual experiences that you're describing. And then there's another which is much more a sort of wrecking type of behavior, where effectively through a form of kind of sort of performed violence, really, of a sort of Trump-like figure, you come along and you just sort of explode and make it impossible to actually hear other things in any kind of other way. And I think that's the sort of, so maybe again, we can sort of think about these different, you know, what might truthful anger versus dishonest anger look like?
I think it's not an accident that you say performed anger. I mean, one of the really interesting things about a lot of these figureheads, Trump's psychology is completely impenetrable to me.
Sure, but
you know, some of the shock jocks, we would call them, like American leaders of these kind of conservative radio shows, which, by the way, is a good way to make like several hundred million dollars. These people are doing very well for themselves.
Yeah, sure.
One of the super interesting things about speaking to them behind the scenes is that often they'll say, like, I don't think this.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course I don't think this. It's a paycheck. It's showbiz. Mm. I mean, it wasn't...
Yeah. Alex Jones said that, didn't
Alex Jones, literally, in his custody dispute, his ex-wife was like, look at this man. Alex Jones is a puce-screaming conspiracy theorist. Of course he shouldn't be allowed to raise my child. To which Alex Jones replied, I'm not really that. That's my persona. I'm a responsible and reasonable father. And, you know, it was several thousand years ago that Plato and Aristotle were realizing that rhetoric rouses the emotions, and were grappling with the intense suspicion that raises of rhetoric as, like, whether it should even be allowed. And, I mean, yeah, the lack of sincerity in some of that stuff is its source of a deep necrosis.
It's definitely experienced in the Australian media industry. Some of our most outrageous columnists behind the scenes, you know, we all move in the same circles. It's not a very big industry. Behind the scenes, people say, oh, but they're actually really nice in real life. Or they don't actually think that, they just say that for the paper. Like, they can separate their public persona from their private. You can still be a good person and write these things, which I think they're allowed to get away with that too much. No, you don't get to say, oh, they treat me well. You know, I'm not going to defame anyone, but I'm sure you can all guess who I'm talking about. You know, ex-News Corp columnist is actually quite nice behind the scenes, you know, and great chat. Who cares? We don't care what they're like behind the scenes. What they're saying publicly is what matters.
And this is why it's so deeply peculiar that we should inherit a model of what actually changes people's minds from the kind of performed non-persuasion that we see from these people. Because it's, of course, it's not going to be a guide to what works on real people, because when they're doing it, they're not being real people.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, I'm very much for
trying to establish, you know, a progressive politics that's in dialogue with the real world and empirical science and so on and so forth. But one of the things that I tried to look at in my book was the experience of the early social movements in the 60s and the 70s and the element of kind of ecstatic, carnivalesque emotion that comes through these movements. I mean, you talk to people who were at the first Mardi Gras march, for instance, and they talk about being harassed by the police and beaten up and thrown in the cells, and then they say, it was the greatest day of my life. Because they had this sort of sense that they were, for the first time, they were coming out, they were owning their sexuality, they were defying authorities, they were doing it collectively. They believed that they were changing the world and they were part of a collective movement. And it's such a different way of thinking about politics to the way that we often put it to today. Very often, progressives explain politics like fighting climate change as this dreary drudgery that you have to do. It's boring as fuck, but someone's got to do it. You know, we have to make sacrifices. And that's not the way that social movements have ever been built. Even something like the Extinction Rebellion protests that have been starting to happen in London, you get a sense of it then, that people coming together and feeling that collectively they're changing their world. There is a peculiar kind of happiness and joy that comes through that that you don't get from any other experience. Anyone who's been in a social movement will know what I'm talking about.
So emotion, it does matter. Right, it does matter. And I think it has been driving a lot of the identity politics in the left in the last few years. And I think obviously identity politics can be a very good thing. It's giving a voice to people who have previously been very oppressed and not listened to. But does that sometimes come at the expense of solidarity on the left, do you think, Jeff?
I mean, this is a big can of worms that I feel like we could discuss for a long period of time. I mean, identity has always been central to any kind of social movement. I remember reading the accounts of British travellers going to France immediately after the French Revolution and describing how people are suddenly wearing different sorts of clothing and they're using different sorts of terminology to talk to each other. And, you know, there's been this sort of massive cultural change, and you kind of half expect these British travellers to say it's political correct. It's gone mad over there in France, because every time you're engaged in some kind of social change, you have to establish yourself as a different kind of person. I am the kind of person who no longer accepts oppression. I am the kind of person who fights back against it. So identity has always been central to progressive politics. So I think a lot hinges on what you mean by identity politics. And I suppose what I talk about in the book is a tendency to see social change purely at the level of culture, of symbols, of gestural politics, rather than the kind of priorities that were perhaps associated with the social movements in an earlier phase, where there was very much a focus on ordinary people changing the structures of society. And so it's quite a difference between, say, a campaign to fight racism that's based on, say, creating jobs for African American people, compared to a campaign to fight racism which is primarily about talking about, I don't know, the kind of terminology that people use on a TV show. I mean, these are obviously grotesque exaggerations, but you see what I mean. There's a shift from a social and structural transformation from more of a focus on symbolism. And the latter is what I would associate with identity politics, which I think, and I think does become quite a problematic gesture.
William, do you think the left at the moment is too focused on symbolism and not actual change?
I wouldn't say that. I think everybody wants change. I think, I mean, there's a couple of things to say about identity politics. One is, of course, that white nationalists are also engaged in identity politics now as well. And that's one of the difficulties, is that they, people like Richard Spencer, would say that he's simply doing what Black Lives Matter or some other type of political movement is doing, but he's doing it on behalf of the white race that he loves. That's all he claims to be doing. And he believes is under attack in some sense. Now, of course, we can sort of call that out for what it is, but nevertheless, there's a sort of, you know, we have to see how these kind of languages get out of control in certain respects. I suppose, I don't think that the left is giving up on social transformation. I mean, I think that these things can be knitted together in lots of ways. I think that there is, at a certain point, the question of what does shared progress actually look like? At what point do, and this is particularly, I think, this affects the right as well, is what kind of society do you want where these sorts of demands would actually be satisfied in some way? And I think that's not always very, very clear, because we have a very good infrastructure for the vocalization of pain and of marginalization and resentment, but it's not such a good infrastructure for the representation of policy, which is a rather sort of, tedious thing in comparison to some of the kind of politics that we see around us today. But I think we mustn't forget what policy would actually do and look like and offer to some of the kind of movements we're talking about.
And Eleanor, just on a more philosophical level, what is it that creates our identities?
Oh, real quick, yeah, sure. Let's do that.
We're going to throw to the audience in a second as well. So, think of your questions.
Let me do
it. Get ready to ask Eleanor to solve the world.
Let me do what you're not meant to do on stage at a writers' festival. I don't know. It is something that really came out in speaking to the people in the book and in gathering their stories about changing their minds was that the self that they had when they believed this really important thing was often very different from the self that they had after they changed their mind. And, in every single one of the stories, I think, in stories about leaving cult, in the story about changing your mind about your actual, archetypical identity, story about grappling with huge uncertainty about whether you were abused as a child, even my story about walking around in King's Cross, every single one of them encountered almost like a moment of grief when someone changed their mind, which was a sort of loss for the person that they had been when they had the coherence that belief gave them. And I don't know what that illuminates about selfhood and the nature of identity, but I do know that it means that if we're serious about changing people's minds in an intimate and one-on-one way, there's a lot to be said for helping them through that grief and helping them construct a new self and a one that is arguably better once they've found a new set of beliefs.
I mean, this is a mourning process that you're describing effectively, and it's sort of, it's the distinction which Freud made between mourning and melancholia, where one actually involves a journey and a relinquishing of the past in some sense, and the other involves a feverish, obsessive grasping of the past and a refusal to give up on some kind of set of a belief system or a set of injuries or a feeling of victimhood or whatever it might be, which I included the right in that, incidentally. So I think that's an interesting, I think what you're saying there, the kind of psychoanalytic implications, I think are really rich, and what that means politically obviously is a slightly separate issue. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Brilliant. Do we have questions in the audience? Oh yes, we do have lots. This man at the front and then a woman down the back. And
hi. I was just wondering how you would filter what you've got to say through the prism of religious belief, because you seem to be talking a lot about belief, and a lot of what you're talking about seems to indicate what I, as an atheist, would attribute to the kind of willful refusal to confront reality that underpins all religion.
Who wants to tackle that one?
I mean, it depends what you mean by religion, doesn't it? And that's a whole other session in itself. One of the difficulties I have with the contemporary atheist movement as represented by the Dawkins and the Hitchens and the Sam Harris, the whole new atheist phenomenon, is it tends to explain religion as simply a matter of doctrine and a matter of false doctrine. And that's one way of thinking about religion, but that's not all religion is. Religion is also an aesthetic. Religion is also an organization. Religion is also a particular set of scripts for kind of behaviors. Religion is also an organizational structure for politics and the rest of it. And when you put it like that, I think you can it gives you a lot more context for understanding how religious people of faith react in certain contexts, that there are certain contexts where religious people can be at the forefront of progressive movements and their religious faith can be an important part of that. And I guess the problem I've had with the new atheist movement is it tends to be a finger-waving, scolding thing at religious people. You people are just idiots. You know, you're just stupid. And A, it's not true. There's no evidence at all to suggest religious people are any dumber than anyone else. And B, nothing follows from that. It's not a way to convince people out of religious belief. It seems to me that, you know, the way that, you know, the real way to argue for atheism is to create a world where religious belief is no longer necessary, and that's quite a different project.
Can I say a slightly philosophical addendum to that?
Of course.
I'm sensitive of time, but what's your name? Colin. Okay, Colin. Right now, would you say that you believe me when I say that I've interviewed all these people about how they changed their minds? Right, you have no reason not to. But so far, you haven't read the book. You haven't heard my tape. You didn't see me fly to San Diego on Saturday to talk to the woman who was uncertain about her own abuse. Thus far, it seems very structurally similar that you're taking what I've said on faith. And I think there's something really... And I don't think that that's comparable to religion. But I do think that if we're going to talk about what's wrong when people believe things out of a willful refusal to face reality, which was a phrase that you used, I think that philosophically, we're going to need to get a lot more fine-grained than just attributing that to things like faith or things like believing in the absence of evidence, because there are plenty of cases, I think, in our interpersonal lives that we form beliefs all the time on the back of what seems like an insufficiency of evidence. And there are really rich questions that I think we need to be up for asking about what makes some of them okay and some of them completely dangerous and daft.
Talking about the feelings in politics, right from Mark Antony, what he did was on feelings. The French Revolution was on feelings. American Revolution was also based on some kind of feelings on people. The Nazi movement was the same. And what we have today, as far as I understand, only that it is being expressed in the form online, and the medium has changed. But in effect, the feelings were always there all through history. Now, my thing is, for a long time, we have heard the term intellectual honesty. Now, is there anything called emotional honesty?
Wow. Big question.
Might be a question for William, perhaps.
Well, one thing about that, I mean, I think, and this partly relates back to the question of revolution as well. I mean, what we've partly seen in the West over the last decade is that the emotions have been a legitimate part of social and public life since the 1960s as individualized sources of authenticity and honesty. And yet the solution that Western democracies came up with for that problem was the market, not politics. Was that you could be anyone you want to be, you can be as an authentic self, you can be an individual emotional being, and you will channel that into the way you shop and the way you invest and the way you invent yourself for the marketplace. What I think we've seen since the great financial crisis, of the global financial crisis of 2008, is that that has broken the bounds of the market and become a political phenomenon, and that's where you see this kind of populism that we see around us today. Now, what would emotional honesty look like? Well, we can all sort of understand what it means to be emotionally honest and talk about our feelings and so on. I think that, I mean, I would subscribe to a philosophical view of emotions that they cannot be spoken of as matters of fact, in the sense that emotions are intersubjective social phenomena. They're not things that reside inside me, like my blood pressure or my heart rate or something like that. Therefore, I can't report on them in the same factual way that I can talk about my height or something like that. But nevertheless, so honesty about emotions is something that happens collectively. It's not something that an individual sort of agrees or disagrees to do. And you can't, how do you know if someone's lying about their feelings? Well, the kind of neuro-industrial complex will say, well, we can track it in your brain or something like that. Even then, I don't buy that, because something happening in a kind of synapse is not the same thing as saying, I feel joyful right now. So I don't think that we can expect emotions to generate the level of kind of objective facts, although there is a huge area of the kind of market research industry that wants that to be the case. We have to carry on treating emotions as social and therefore political phenomena, I think.
So we've run out of time. So on the hefty subjects of emotion and capitalism, we'll have to finish it there. There will be a book signing just next door. So any other big questions you have for these three, you can ask there and buy their books, obviously. Could you please join me in thanking them?
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.